everyone. This is Tom Regan. I'm a licensed addiction counselor and certified grief counselor for Heartview Foundation in Bismarck. And welcome to Recovery Chronicles. This is a half-hour interview program during which we celebrate recovery with a capital R from alcohol and drug addiction. And our very special guest today is someone that I know because I work with her, and she's a person in long-term recovery. And her name is Melissa Whitney. She's 34 years old, originally from Jamestown, and moved to Bismarck in about 1998. So, hi, Melissa. Thanks for agreeing to be on the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Did it take a little courage to say yes to be on the radio with me?
I don't think I really knew, so I just said, yeah, you asked me to do something, sure.
Yeah, you're neat. You're neat. You know, and you won't be surprised at this, but, you know, what I have found is that, you know, we who are in recovery feel obligated in a way to share our success and to tell our story because we think it may help others. And
absolutely.
So I'm sure you feel that way. And so tell us a little bit about your growing up years and what that was like.
Growing up, I grew up, my parents have been together since they were 15 and 16 years old, and they're still together to this day.
Oh, nice.
And so we had, when I say a normal family, you know, mom and dad both worked. Dad went to school at night to get himself through college. I had two older brothers. I was the youngest. So we really essentially had a normal family. There was no drug usage. I had never seen my parents drunk, nor have I to this day.
Were they social drinkers?
No. I mean, I don't remember alcohol really ever being a part of our lives.
Is that your drug of choice, alcohol?
It is. My drug of choice is alcohol. Yeah.
So when did you find out that alcohol might be for you, or when were you first exposed to it?
I was in seventh grade. Mm-hmm. Seventh grade was the first time, and we had older friends, and we went to their house. I think it was a friend's aunt or something had bought us alcohol, and. my first drink was a blackout drunk.
Yeah.
You know, it was a lot of alcohol at one time.
Yeah.
So that was my very first encounter, and I liked it.
Yeah,
It was a good experience.
Did you get sick?
I did. I got very sick.
You know, you just brought back a memory, and that's one of the dangers of being inexperienced and drinking too much. There was an older fellow who bought me a bottle of tequila. I asked him to. Mm-hmm. He had no business doing that. I think I was 16. But so I invited three or four friends over, and we drank that darn thing. And it was blackout.
Yeah.
And of course, I was living at home. I come from a so-called normal family. And I was puking in my sleep, which, you know, I could have died because people aspirate. So there's just a lot of danger in that. We're lucky to be alive, I guess.
Yeah. At that point, it was funny. You know, people, it was a funny thing because I was so sick. But looking back, definitely at that age, it was a very scary thing.
What did you like about it?
I've always been one that's very self-conscious. Mm-hmm. So alcohol made me sociable. It made me feel like I was cool and I fit in and it was accepted.
Yeah.
And I didn't have those reservations anymore.
It was a lubricator, you know.
Yeah, my
social.
Liquid courage is what I called it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yep.
Yeah, I think I was shy and had anxiety, and you know, a few beers, and I was the life of the party, or at least I thought I was.
Yep, I agree.
So your use continued in high school and beyond.
I drank a few times, and I remember trying marijuana and dabbling in other different things in Jamestown. But middle of ninth grade, I moved to Bismarck, and at that time, you know, the schools ran 7th, 8th, and 9th. So by ninth grade, middle of ninth grade, everybody had all their friends and their groups and their sports. And going into a new community at that age, I didn't join the sports like I was in. I didn't get involved in any of that because they were already established.
Sure.
So I went towards the people that would accept me, and they happened to be the people that did drugs and drank. Mm-hmm. So I went straight into a very downward spiral of drinking and drugs very heavily in high school.
Right. What high school did you go to? And we're not trying to blame the high school.
But and it was the kids that didn't even go to school most of the time.
Oh, I see.
Very heavily daily use of alcohol and marijuana throughout the entire high school years. Mm.
Yeah. And then, and how much, what was your favorite alcoholic beverage?
You know, I think at that time, from what I can remember, we drank a lot of beer because it was, it was easy. It was cheaper.
Sure.
So that's, you know, at, even at my job at that time, they would go get alcohol and bring it into the cooler at work. I worked at a fast food restaurant. And so not even just with my school friends, but I was working at 15 and the management would go get alcohol at the gas station and bring it into the cooler and we would drink at work.
Yeah.
So it was definitely a huge part of my daily.
Sure. How much toward the end, I mean, how much could you drink and still function, so to speak, or still be standing or what have you?
You know, not my disease progressed to the point that I became a binge drinker because it was no longer okay to drink every day. I was trying to hide it and not drink. So I would be able to go time periods without drinking. But then when I did, there was bottles and bottles and bottles. You know, I'd go on a blackout for 4 or 5 days and wake up from that blackout and people had dumped things. You know, family would come in and dump things while I was in a blackout or they'd pour it out, but I'd find more. But it would be, you know, 8, 9, 10 bottles of vodka or, you know, it was a lot.
So you went from beer to the hard stuff.
Yeah. Towards when the disease progressed, you know, it went from that social thing into a need.
Yes.
It went from wanting to be social to introverted, locking myself in the house and not leaving for days and hiding it and lying about it because people saw that there was a problem and I didn't want them to take away my friend, my thing that kept me alive. So I would hide it so that they wouldn't take it away.
So this sounds like a kind of hell on earth, right?
Absolutely.
This loneliness, this isolation, this this constant need. And so when did you see the light? What happened? Any legal or?
For many years, so I started going to, I went from an everyday drinking in probably 2012 to a binge drinking because I started treatment. I finally, my family and friends were concerned enough to say, you need help.
Good.
And I'm a pleaser. That's kind of my, so I want to please the people around me. I want to do good. You know, if they tell me I got a problem, I want to fix it. And unfortunately, it's not fixable per se. And treatment didn't fix me.
Yeah.
And so I'd go to treatment and think I was fixed and then I could drink again.
I see.
So that's when the binging came, that I would be good for a few months or a few weeks, and then I would relapse. I've had many DUIs. I think I've had a total of 10 in my lifetime.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the last straw that got me into long-term recovery is I flipped a vehicle down in Tennessee when I was living down there trying to get away from my disease. I decided to move across the country.
Oh, yeah. A geographical cure.
Yep. Thought if I moved down there, it would go away. I flipped a vehicle and had to be cut out. And so I came back up to North Dakota to be closer to family and recovery and went back into Heartview. And just kind of, I forgot about my program. I forgot about my recovery. I put work and financial and everything else in front of that. And I think, and I drank one night and woke up 6 days later with another DUI. And that was it for me. That was just enough.
Our histories are pretty similar. In my past, I totaled two vehicles and it was really that last one that, it drove me into treatment, you might say. I rolled a vehicle. I was not strapped in. The good news is that I only hurt myself. I could have killed someone. Some family, some children, and those were very depressing days when I realized I had lost it. I had lost control, and I literally didn't know what I was going to do next. And so, have you been in multiple treatments?
I have. I have had two inpatient treatments, you know, four or five outpatient treatments. And when I went into treatment, I would be able to, you know, stay sober throughout the whole treatment. And I have that good game face that I could say what you want to hear. I could do what I needed to do because I had to. It was the minute I was out of services that there wasn't anything making me. You know, I'd regained the graces of my family and I was good with them again. And then I'd start forgetting, all that turmoil that I had caused and all the things, all the hurt that I had caused. And, you know, in this process, I lost custody of my child too.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'd start forgetting all that stuff. And then my brain, you know, the disease would start telling me, you need a drink, you know, so then I would relapse.
You need a drink or you deserve a drink.
Yep, you deserve one. Yep.
Yeah. How old is your child?
He's 13. He just turned 13 the day after Mother's Day.
Oh, yeah. And you have a good relationship now and you
Now I do. You know, when I lost custody of him when I drank with him in the car. I drove with him in the car and he was old enough at that point to say, Dad, this is what happened because his dad and I are not together and Dad stepped in, which...
Sure.
At the time, I was very angry.
But
I look back now and I say, you know, that's what a good parent does. They step in and they protect their child. And so he got custody of Alex. Yeah.
And I should say, our guest is Melissa Whitney.
Yep.
And she's from Bismarck now, but originally from Jamestown. And she happens to work at Heartview. So I get to see her almost every day. And so how long have you been in recovery?
I celebrated my 1 year April 19th.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's wonderful. And what do you think has made the difference in this, I don't want to say in this time around, but I mean, you've experienced long-term recovery now over a year. And so what's made the difference or what are some of the secrets to?
I've wanted it for a long time. I think I've been working towards it for a few years now. And so I think this last time, I don't want to say a job did it for me, but I think the job that I needed stepped in, and I say it was a God thing that I just happened to apply at Heartview thinking there's no way I'm still in services. There's no way that they will hire me. And they did, and they had that faith in me. And I always forgot the destruction that I caused, and I forgot that I had a disease, or my brain would bury that fact that I had this disease, and I'd end up relapsing. And I think Heartview... That's my 5 day a week reminder when I see people that are broken come in. That's my reminder to me that I'm one of them. That's me right there. And I can't, this is what's going to happen if I drink again.
Yeah.
So it's a God thing. You know, I say Heartview or an employment, but you know, it's the people that walk into there, that are struggling that make me remember every single day that I have this disease and I need to stay on, you know, I need to focus on it and remember it.
So you're literally living your program every day on many levels. And that's the way I feel as a counselor.
Yep.
I mean, I have to walk and talk recovery. There's an obligation there. There's a responsibility.
Absolutely.
And so, so do you mind telling us what you do at Heartview?
I'm an administrative assistant. Yeah. So, you know, we take those phone calls from the people from... You know, the moms and the dads and the best friends and the sisters and the patients that call in and say, I need help. You know, I'm really bad. I need help. What can I do to help my brother? What can I do to help my daughter? And, you know, there's some days that I hang up that phone and there's tears in my eyes
because I know.
You remember that and think, oh, my God, I put my mom through that. You know, that's what my mom did when I was blackout drunk calling these places. Sure. So,
we all... It can be a very emotional place to work when you're working for at an addiction treatment center, because guess what? Sometimes those patients disappoint us in some pretty major ways. And I'm glad you brought up talking to moms and dads because, as you know, we run the Monday Night Heart Group, which is a free support group. Especially for parents, but for anyone who lives with or who needs or who knows an addict, words are falling short. But I've spoken at the Heart, which is 6 o'clock on Monday nights. But so many moms and dads is what I'm trying to say. So many moms and dads attend, and husbands and wives, and brothers and sisters, and you know, fiancés. And so what do you say to these moms who call and they're so frustrated and they're looking for help or support?
You know, it's every phone call is a little bit different as far as what they want and what they need. And the part that's hard is usually I can't say bring them in. Bring them in, we'll help them. You know, I let them know what is out there for help, you know, that we can get them, you know, on our list or whatever the need may be that we can get them started in that process. That, you know, if the patient is willing,
Right.
To have them come in and we can meet with them and do an evaluation or resident, you know, it depends on that situation.
Yes.
If the patient's unwilling, we give them options as far as what they can do as a parent to try to get them help, or as a brother or as a sister. Mm-hmm. If they're not willing to help themselves, the options that they have through the legal and hospital chains to try to get them assistance, you know, because sometimes when you're in the depths of the disease, you don't know how to help yourself.
Right.
And, you know, like I've explained to them I know that fear of having my alcohol taken away. I would fight tooth and nail to the ends of the earth if I knew someone was taking that bottle away from me when I was in an active use.
Sure.
And I try to explain that to the parents and things too, that, you know, you anger and things like that. We know, but those people they're scared. They're terrified that you're going to take their drug or alcohol away because they don't know if they can live without it.
Right. It's been their best friend.
Exactly.
It's been their crutch. It's been their companion. I know there was one particular night, and I was speaking at the Monday night heart group. And that heart, by the way, stands for Helping Everyone Achieve Recovery Today. It's one of those sort of wacky acronyms. And again, it's free and downtown Bismarck, First and Broadway. But I felt particularly frustrated as a counselor because so many of these parents were expressing the frustration that their son or daughter has been through so many treatments and made so many promises, and they always go back to it. And I actually left that group that night feeling like a failure because I was at a loss for words. And then something, maybe this was a God thing, but then it dawned on me, and this applies to you too. I show these parents and brothers and sisters that it's possible through my own recovery.
Yep.
I've put lots of years of recovery together, and that's the best thing I can do. I can show them by my own life, through my own happiness, through my many years of recovery, that it is possible. And I've also said to people at times, and I'm sorry for talking about myself so much, but I also say to people sometimes, I think it's in my job description to smile, because I've been recovered, you know, and so every day is precious. And then I also think, well, you know, why would anyone want to hang from me or learn from me if I was grumpy all the time, you know?
It's offering that bit of hope to people, you know, that little tiny bit of hope, just so they can see that, you know, that it's got to be possible. I mean, look, this gentleman smiling, happy, and obviously successful being a licensed addiction counselor. There's got to be hope in there. So that's what people need. They need that little bit of hope that their son, daughter, brother, sister can survive the disease, and that they can come out, you know, as a person.
Sure.
You know, that there's a person still in there that they care about.
Yeah, I was... Right. What's the most frustrating part of your job? You know, is there, challenging as you work with?
I don't want to say frustrating. Mm-hmm. I think the hardest part of the job is seeing people come in and, again, they have that light. You know, they start getting better. And then, you know, they call after, you know, they get discharged or whatever the situation may be, and they relapsed.
Yeah.
And that's that heart, that's that,
right.
You know, because you want so badly to see every single person succeed.
Yep.
And knowing, you know, I didn't, but I want them to. So that's probably the hardest part of the job is knowing people have relapsed and
that's frustrating.
Trying to get them back, you know, trying to get them back in because, you know, some people, I always was told as an alcoholic, I may not have another relapse in me. You know, because, you know, once you relapse, it's not a guarantee you're going to go back in. And you may, you know,
that's right.
Many chances if I didn't have my family that I probably would have just drank myself to death if I wouldn't have had them step in and say, Melissa, you know, make those necessary actions to get me to stop drinking. I would have drank myself to death.
Yeah, I hear one of my favorite sayings that you hear at support group meetings is you say, "Well, I know I've got another drunk in me, but I don't know if I have another recovery in me." And that is so true, because mm-hmm. you start going down that road, and then as far as the relapses, I try to remind myself that it is a chronic disease. You know, just like a lung disease, or just like a cancer. I mean, it's chronic, which means it tries to come back. Yep. And so that knowing that maybe helps me a little bit with dealing with the relapsing. But hey, I walk out of that building sometimes saying, "Oh, those darn addicts, they're so hard. There they go again, you know, or there he goes again, or there, you know." But anyway.
I was told the other day that our patients will disappoint you. Mm-hmm. Don't worry, they will.
Yeah.
But because they're sick, you know, they wouldn't be here. They wouldn't be patients if they weren't sick. So they're going to disappoint you.
Good advice.
Yep.
Good advice.
Which is, you know, they're still sick. They're
and I remember recovered. Early on, too, you know, one of my mentors, if you know what I mean, you know, saying, reminding me, and many times really saying, you know, in my early days of recovery, they would say, "Well, you know, you've been mentally and physically and emotionally and spiritually ill. And so why would you expect to get better right away? It's going to take you some time." Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
So it's okay if you disappoint yourself once in a while.
Expect perfection. And I think that was part of my thing that I'd always relapse is I'd go to treatment and I'd want it gone.
Yeah.
I'd want this disease gone. I'd want to go back to a normal human being and not have to deal with with the addiction anymore. And it just doesn't work that
right. way. Right. Right. And I remember how angry I was, early on that I had to stop, to quit drinking and saying stupid, because I was about age 28 and saying stupid things to myself, like, "How am I ever going to have fun again?" and that can be part of it too. Just, "Oh, I can't do this. I'm disappointed. That's what I do."
Yeah, why me? I said that a lot between my brothers and my sister. None of them got the disease. I called it. You know, why me?
Why
did I get that? This isn't fair. Why did I have to deal with this?
Exactly.
Why can't I be normal like them?
And then you may be on the pity pot about that. And no, that's so. I'll ask you a real personal question now. Has spirituality been a part of your recovery?
Prior mm-hmm. to about 2 years ago, I did not believe there was a God. Mm-hmm. I didn't. That was part that I always knew I was missing in my recovery.
Yeah,
didn't believe in it. Let me tell you something about those Southern churches down in Alabama. I walked into one and I went on my own. I just decided I was missing something. I felt there was an emptiness in me. I was sober, but there was an emptiness, and there was a church that was right around the corner from where I was living. And I decided to go into it, and it was, The Rock. It was a recovery based church.
Oh,
And they have those down South. The whole church is based on recovery.
Nice.
And I went to it, and
we should have that here.
We should. And I sat there and I bawled because that message, and it hit me. And from then on, I started going and I felt it. And I think that's, you know, I listened before and I'm these people are dumb.
Yeah.
How can they believe this?
Yeah.
But I wasn't ready. Mm. I wasn't ready to hear it then. And I was finally ready to hear the message that I needed to hear. So it is now.
Yeah.
It was never before.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm so proud of the fact that folks, I'm not trying to do a commercial for HeartView here, but I'm so proud of the fact that HeartView sponsors many on-site meetings, mm-hmm. you know, and to assist people in recovery. I mean, the entire community, really. We invite the entire community, and some of these meetings are open meetings, which means anyone can attend. And I mean, that's part of the representative of the spirituality side of recovery. And it's always been important in my recovery. It probably because I was raised a pretty devout Irish Catholic, and it wasn't a big jump for me. I told you this would go fast, and we're actually nearing the end of the program. And I'll mention again, our guest is Melissa Whitney, and she's 34 years old, a person in long-term recovery, and happens to work at Heartview. But so a lot of people listen to this radio program. I mean, it's really catching on, and people listen in podcast form, and that's on KDACFM.org website. And so what do you say to the person right now who's listening and they know they're in trouble and they know they need to go to treatment and they've been putting it off and putting it off? And what do you say to them? What's your best advice to them?
Let people help you.
Uh-huh.
That was one of my biggest things, is I was too prideful. I didn't want people to help me. I can do this on my own, and you can't. So just put that pride down and let people help you until you are able to help yourself, and reach out to the people that can help you and let them, mm-hmm. you know.
Sure.
That was probably my biggest thing, is I would not let the people that cared about me help me.
Yeah. Well, why do you think?
Pride.
Uh-huh.
Fear that my alcohol was going to be taken away. That they'd know all my demons, they'd know all my tricks, they'd know all my lies, they'd know all my secrets, and then I wouldn't be able to get away with it anymore.
Yeah. And then be honest, right? I mean, and it's hard to fess up, mm-hmm. you know, about our lives and you know, how much we used and what we did, and it's hard to fess up.
The people that care about us, they already know anyway.
Yeah.
They don't know the extent of it, but they don't care at that point. They already know that we're an addict or alcoholic, and we need some help. And if you're willing to be honest about it, they probably already know, even though we don't think they do. They do.
And nobody knows better than another person in recovery.
Absolutely.
You know, hence the effectiveness of group therapy and everything. Mm-hmm. And we know, she's just like I am. this sounds real familiar as we all begin to share our lives, you know.
So, absolutely.
That's part of the magic of it. So plans for the future for yourself. You know, you've been a great employee at Heartview.
I'm just okay with being okay for right now.
Yeah.
I just moved into a condo in Mandan and establishing a normalcy for myself again, you know, because it takes a while to crawl out of that hole that you've created for yourself. And so I'm finally now at a feeling normal, and I'm okay. I'm okay with today. So right now I'm just working on being okay with today.
Yeah. So this is, you're kind of entering what might be the best of times for you, you know, for a while. You're at the early stage of the best of times, I hope.
Yeah, whatever comes, I'm open to, you know, I look forward to the future. And I have that hope of, you know, I don't know what tomorrow brings, but bring it on. I'm good. Yeah. I'm good today, and whatever tomorrow brings, I'll be okay with tomorrow, too.
Sure. Our time is up.
All right.
Our guest has been Melissa Whitney from Heartview. Thank you so much. And
This won't
surprise you. We close every week with the Serenity Prayer. So why don't you pray it with me? And that's, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you, Tom.
I sing the song because I love the man. I know that some of you don't understand. Milk blood to keep from running out. I've seen the needle and the damage done, a little part of it in everyone, but every junkie's like a setting sun.